end of the central basin still was not finished, even though it was to be a key feature of the opening ceremony. A test was scheduled for the following day, Saturday. "It does not look ready by any means," Olmsted wrote, "but it is expected that it will play before the president next Monday." As for the work under his own department, Olmsted was disappointed. He had hoped to accomplish far more by now. He knew also that others shared his disappointment. "I get wind of much misplaced criticism by men as clever even as Burnham because of impressions from incomplete work and undeveloped compositions," he wrote. He knew that in many places the grounds did look sparse and unkempt, and that much work remained. Anyone could see the gaps. But to hear about it from others, especially from a man whom he admired and respected, was profoundly depressing. The deadline was immutable. Too much had been set in motion for anyone even to consider postponement. The opening ceremony was scheduled to begin, would begin, on Monday morning with a parade from the Loop to Jackson Park, led by the new president of the United States, Grover Cleveland. Train after train now entered Chicago, bringing statesmen, princes, and tycoons from all over the world. President Cleveland arrived with his vice president and a retinue of cabinet officials, senators and military leaders, and their wives, children, and friends. The rain steamed off black locomotives. Porters hauled great trunks from the baggage cars. Caravans of water-slicked black carriages lined the streets outside the city's train stations, their red waiting lights haloed by the rain. The hours slipped past. On the evening of April 30th, the night before opening day, a British reporter named F. Herbert Stead visited the fairgrounds. The name Stead was well known in America because of Herbert's more famous brother, William, the former editor of London's Pall Mall Gazette and recent founder of the Review of Reviews. Assigned to cover the opening ceremony, Herbert decided to scout the grounds ahead of time to get a more detailed sense of the fair's topography. It was raining hard when he exited his carriage and entered Jackson Park. Lights blazed everywhere as shawls of rain unfurled around them. The ponds that had replaced Olmsted's elegant paths shuddered under the impact of a billion falling droplets. Hundreds of empty freight cars stood black against the lights. Lumber and empty crates and the remains of workers' lunches lay everywhere. The whole scene was heartbreaking, but also perplexing. The fair's opening day celebration was set to begin the next morning, yet the grounds were clotted with litter and debris. In a state, Stead wrote, of gross incompleteness. The rain continued through the night. Later that Sunday night, as rain thumped their windowsills, editors of Chicago's morning dailies laid out bold and elaborate headlines for Monday's historic editions. Not since the Chicago Fire of 1871 had the city's newspapers been so galvanized by a single event. But there was more quotidian work to be done as well. The more junior typesetters leaded and shimmed the classifieds and personals and all the other advertisements that filled the inside pages. Some that night worked on a small notice announcing the opening of a new hotel. Clearly another hastily built affair meant to capitalize on the expected crush of exposition visitors. This hotel at least seemed to be well located, at 63rd and Wallace in Englewood, a short ride on the new Alley L from the fair's 64th Street gate. The owner called it the World's Fair Hotel. Part 3. In the White City, May to October, 1893. Opening Day. 23 gleaming black carriages stood in the yellow mud of Michigan Avenue in front of the Lexington Hotel. President Cleveland boarded the 7th carriage, a landau. Burnham and Davis shared the 6th. Both men behaved, although they still had not shed their mutual distrust, nor resolved their struggle for supreme control of the fair. The Duke of Veragua, the last living descendant of Columbus, sat in the 14th carriage. The Duchess occupied the 15th with Bertha Palmer, whose diamonds radiated an almost palpable heat. Mayor Harrison took the very last carriage and drew the loudest cheers. Assorted other dignitaries filled the remaining carriages. As the procession rumbled south along Michigan Avenue toward Jackson Park, the street behind became a following sea of 200,000 Chicagoans on foot and horseback, in phaetons, victorias, and stanhopes, and packed into omnibuses and streetcars. Many thousands of others boarded trains and jammed the bright yellow cars dubbed cattle cars, built by the Illinois Central to haul as many people as possible to the fair. Anyone with a white handkerchief waved it, and white flags hung from every lamppost. Damp bunting swelled from building facades. 1,500 members of the Columbian Guard in their new uniforms of light blue sackcloth, white gloves, and yellow-lined black capes met the throng and cordially directed everyone to the administration building, recognizable by its lofty gold dome. The procession approached the fair from the west through the Midway Plaisance. Just as the president's carriage turned into the Avenue of Nations, which ran the 13-block length of the Midway, the sun emerged, igniting a roar of approval from spectators as it lit the 40 concessions that lined the avenue, some the size of small towns. The carriages rolled past Sitting Bull's Cabin, the Lapland Village, the compound of the allegedly cannibalistic Dahomans, and, directly opposite, the California Ostrich Farm, redolent of simmering butter and eggs. The farm offered omelets made from ostrich eggs, though in fact the eggs came from domestic chickens. The procession passed the Austrian Village and Captive Balloon Park, where a hydrogen balloon tethered to the ground took visitors aloft. At the center of the Midway, the procession veered around the woefully incomplete Ferris wheel, which Burnham eyed with displeasure. It was a half-moon of steel encased in a skyscraper of wooden falsework. When President Cleveland's carriage came to Saul Bloom's Algerian village at the Muslim core of the Midway, Bloom gave a nod, and the women of the village dropped their veils. Bloom swore it was a customary gesture of respect, but of course with Bloom one could never be sure. The carriages skirted the street in Cairo. Not yet open, another disappointment, and past the Turkish village and the Java lunchroom. Outside Hagenbach's animal show, the most famous traveling zoo of the day, handlers prodded four trained lions into full roar. To the right, in the smoky distance, the president saw the banners of Buffalo Bill's Wild West flying over the arena Colonel Cody had built at 62nd Street. At last, the carriages entered Jackson Park. There would be miracles at the fair. The chocolate Venus de Milo would not melt. The 22,000-pound cheese in the Wisconsin Pavilion would not mold. But the greatest miracle was the transformation of the grounds during the long, soggy night that had preceded Cleveland's arrival. When Herbert Stead returned the next morning, a plain of wind-rippled water still covered portions of the park, but the empty boxcars and packing debris were gone. 10,000 men working through the night had touched up the paint and staff and planted pansies and laid sod as 1,000 scrub women washed, waxed, and polished the floors of the great buildings. As the morning advanced, the sun emerged more fully. In the bright, rain-scrubbed air, those portions of the landscape not still submerged looked cheerful, trim, and neat. When the fair opened, said Paul Sterrett, one of Burnham's men, Olmsted's lawns were the first amazement. At 11 o'clock, President Cleveland ascended the stairs to the speaker's platform erected outside the east end of the administration building and took his seat, the signal for the ceremony to begin. The crowd surged forward. 20 women fainted. Reporters lucky enough to be in the front rows rescued one elderly woman by hauling her over a railing and laying her out on a press table. Members of the guard waded in with swords drawn. Mayhem reigned until Director General Davis signaled the orchestra to begin playing the introductory Columbian March. Chastened by criticism of the stupefying length of October's dedication ceremony, the fair's officers had kept the opening day program short and pledged to honor the timetable at all costs. First came a blessing given by a blind chaplain to an audience made deaf by size and distance. Next came a poetic ode to Columbus as long and difficult to endure as the admiral's voyage itself. Then from the Pinta's foretop fell a cry, a trumpet song, "Light ho, light ho, light." That kind of thing. Director General Davis spoke next and offered a meaty helping of distorted reality, praising the way the National Commission, the Exposition Company, and the Board of Lady Managers had worked together without strife to produce such a brilliant exposition. Those privy to the warfare within and between these agencies watched Burnham closely, but saw no change in his expression. Davis offered the podium to the president. Cleveland, immense in black, a human locomotive, paused a moment in sober examination of the crowd before him. Nearby stood a table draped in an American flag, on top of which lay a blue and red velvet pillow, supporting a telegraph key made of gold. Every bit of terrace, lawn, and railing in the Court of Honor was occupied, the men in black and gray, many of the women in gowns of extravagant hues, violet, scarlet, emerald, and wearing hats with ribbons, sprigs, and feathers. A tall man in a huge white hat and a white buckskin coat heavily trimmed in silver stood a full head above the man around him, Buffalo Bill. Women watched him. Sunlight fell between tufts of fast-shredding cloud and lit the white panamas that flecked the audience. From the president's vantage point, the scene was festive and crisp, but at ground level, there was water and mud and a sucking sound made whenever anyone shifted position. The only human form with dry feet was that of Daniel Chester French's The Republic, Big Mary, which stood hidden under a silo of canvas. Cleveland's speech was the shortest of all. As he concluded, he moved to the flag-draped table. "As by a touch the machinery that gives light to this vast exposition is set in motion," he said, "so at the same instant let our hopes and aspirations awaken forces which in all time to come shall influence the welfare, the dignity, and the freedom of mankind." At precisely 12:08, he touched the gold key. A roar radiated outward as successive strata of the crowd learned the key had been pressed. Workmen on rooftops immediately signaled to piers stationed throughout the park and to sailors aboard the warship Michigan anchored in the lake. The key closed an electric circuit which activated the electromagnetic engine stop and starter attached to the giant 3,000-horsepower Alice steam engine at Machinery Hall. The starter's silver-plated gong rang, a sprocket turned, a valve opened, and the engine whooshed to life on exquisitely machined shafts and bearings. Immediately, 30 other engines in the building began to thrum. At the fair's waterworks, 3 huge Worthington pumps began stretching their shafts and pistons, like praying mantises shaking off the cold. Millions of gallons of water began surging through the fair's mains. Engines everywhere took steam until the ground trembled. An American flag the size of a mainsail unfurled from the tallest flagpole in the Court of Honor, and immediately 2 more like-sized flags tumbled from flanking poles, one representing Spain, the other Columbus. Water pressurized by the Worthington pumps exploded from the McMonnies fountain and soared 100 feet into the sky, casting a sheet rainbow across the sun and driving visitors to raise their umbrellas against the spray. Banners and flags and gonfalons suddenly bellied from every cornice, a huge red banner unscrolled along the full length of the machinery hall, and the canvas slipped from Big Mary's gold-leaf shoulders. Sunlight clattering from her skin caused men and women to shield their eyes. 200 white doves leapt for the sky. The guns of the Michigan fired. Steam whistles shrieked. Spontaneously, the throng began to sing My Country, 'Tis of Thee, which many thought of as the national anthem, although no song had yet received that designation. As the crowd thundered, a man eased up beside a thin, pale woman with a bent neck. In the next instant, Jane Addams realized her purse was gone. The great fair had begun. Although Burnham recognized that much work lay ahead, that Olmsted had to redouble his efforts and Ferris needed to finish that damned wheel, the success of the exposition now seemed assured. Congratulations arrived by telegraph and post. A friend told Burnham, "The scene burst on me with the beauty of a full-blown rose." The official history of the fair estimated that 250,000 people packed Jackson Park on opening day. Two other estimates put the total at 500,000 and 620,000. By day's end, there was every indication that Chicago's fair would become the most heavily attended entertainment in the history of the world. This optimism lasted all of 24 hours. On Tuesday, May 2nd, only 10,000 people came to Jackson Park, a rate of attendance that, if continued, would guarantee the fair a place in history as one of the greatest failures of all time. The yellow cattle cars were mostly empty, as were the cars of the Alley L that ran along 63rd Street. All hope that this was merely an anomaly disappeared the next day when the forces that had been battering the nation's economy erupted in a panic on Wall Street that caused stock prices to plummet. And this was only the beginning. On the night of Thursday, May 5th, officials of the National Cordage Company, a trust that controlled 80% of America's rope production, placed itself in receivership. Next, Chicago's Chemical National Bank ceased operation, a closure that seemed particularly ominous to fair officials because Chemical alone had won congressional approval to open a branch at the World's Fair in no less central a location than the administration building. 3 days later, another large Chicago bank failed, and soon after that, a third, the Evanston National Bank in Burnham's town. Dozens of other failures occurred around the country. In Brunswick, Georgia, the presidents of two national banks held a meeting. One president calmly excused himself, entered his private office, and shot himself through the head. Both banks failed. In Lincoln, Nebraska, the Nebraska Savings Bank had become the favorite bank of school children. The town's teachers served as agents of the bank and every week collected money from the children for deposit in each child's passbook account. Word that the bank was near failure caused the street out front to fill with children pleading for their money. Other banks came to Nebraska Savings Rescue, and the so-called children's run was quelled. People who otherwise might have traveled to Chicago to see the fair now stayed home. The terrifying economy was discouraging enough, but so too were reports of the unfinished character of the fair. If people had only one chance to go, they wanted to do it when all the exhibits were in place and every attraction was in operation, especially the Ferris wheel, said to be a marvel of engineering that would make the Eiffel Tower seem like a child's sculpture. Provided it ever actually worked and did not collapse in the first brisk wind. Too many features of the fair remained unfinished, Burnham acknowledged. He and his brigade of architects, draftsmen, engineers, and contractors had accomplished so much in an impossibly short time, but apparently not enough to overcome the damping effect of a fast, degrading economy. The elevators in the manufacturer's building, touted as one of the wonders of the fair, still had not begun operation. The Ferris wheel looked only half-finished. Olmsted had yet to complete grading and planting the grounds around the Krupp Pavilion, the leather building, and the cold storage building. He had not yet laid the brick pavement at the fair's train station or sodded the New York Central exhibit, the Pennsylvania Railroad exhibit, Coral Hall, and the Illinois State Building, which to many Chicagoans was the single most important building at the fair. The installation of exhibits and company pavilions within the electricity building was woefully behind schedule. Westinghouse only began building his pavilion on Tuesday, May 2nd. Burnham issued stern directives to Olmsted and Ferris, and every contractor still at work. Olmsted in particular felt the pressure, but also felt hobbled by the persistent delays in installation of exhibits and the damage done by the repeated comings and goings of drays and freight cars. General Electric alone had 15 carloads of exhibit materials stored on the grounds. Preparations for the opening day ceremony had cost Olmsted's department valuable time, as did the planting and grading required to repair the damage the day's crowd had inflicted throughout the park. Many of the fair's 57 miles of roadway were still either submerged or coated with mud, and others had been gouged and trenched by vehicles that had used the roads while they were still sodden. Olmsted's road contractor deployed a force of 800 men and 100 teams to begin regrading the roads and laying new gravel. "I remain fairly well," Olmsted wrote to his son on May 15th, "but get horribly tired every day. It is hard to get things done. My body is so overworked, and I constantly fail to accomplish what I expect to do." First and foremost, Burnham knew, the fair had to be finished. But in the meantime, lures had to be cast to encourage people to shed their fears of financial ruin and come to Chicago. He created the new post of Director of Functions and assigned Frank Millett to the job, giving him wide latitude to do what he could to boost attendance. Millett orchestrated fireworks shows and parades. He set aside special days to honor individual states and nations and to fete distinct groups of workers, including cobblers, millers, confectioners, and stenographers. The Knights of Pythias got their own day, as did the Catholic Knights of America. Millett set August 25th as Colored People Fete Day and October 9th as Chicago Day. Attendance began to increase, but not by much. By the end of May, the daily average of paying visitors was only 33,000, still far below what Burnham and everyone else had expected, and more to the point, far below the level required to make the fair profitable. Worse yet, Congress and the National Commission, bowing to pressure from the Sabbatarian movement, had ordered the fair closed on Sundays, thus withdrawing its wonders from a few million wage earners for whom Sunday was the only day off. Burnham hoped for an early cure to the nation's financial malaise, but the economy did not oblige. More banks failed, layoffs increased, industrial production sagged, strikes grew more violent. On June 5th, worried depositors staged runs on 8 Chicago banks. Burnham's own firm saw the flow of new commissions come to a halt. A less hospitable time to hold a World's Fair was difficult to imagine. The thought that worse might lie ahead occurred to no one. The World's Fair Hotel. The first guests began arriving at Holmes's World's Fair Hotel, though not in the volume he and every other Southside hotelier had expected. The guests were drawn mainly by the hotel's location, with Jackson Park a short trip east on the 63rd Street leg of the Alley L. Even though the rooms on Holmes's second and third floors were largely empty, when male visitors asked about accommodations, Holmes told them, with a look of sincere regret, that he had no vacancies, and kindly referred them to other hotels nearby. His guest rooms began to fill with women, most quite young and apparently unused to living alone. Holmes found them intoxicating. Minnie Williams' continual presence became increasingly awkward. With the arrival of each dewy new guest, she became more jealous, more inclined to stay close to him. Her jealousy did not particularly annoy him. It simply became inconvenient. Minnie was an asset now, an acquisition, to be warehoused until needed, like cocooned prey. Holmes checked newspaper advertisements for a rental flat far enough from his building to make impromptu visits unlikely. He found a place on the north side at 1220 Wrightwood Avenue, a dozen or so blocks west of Lincoln Park, near Halsted. It was a pretty, shaded portion of the city, though its prettiness was to Holmes merely an element to be entered into his calculations. The flat occupied the top floor of a large private house owned by a man named John Oker, whose daughters managed its rental. They first advertised the flat in April 1893. Holmes went alone to examine the apartment and met John Oker. He introduced himself as Henry Gordon and told Oker he was in the real estate business. Oker was impressed with this prospective tenant. He was neat. Maybe fastidious was the better word, and his clothing and behavior suggested financial well-being. Oker was delighted when Henry Gordon said he would take the apartment, even more delighted when Gordon paid him $40 cash in advance. Gordon told Oker he and his wife would arrive in a few weeks. Holmes explained the move to Minnie as a long overdue necessity. Now that they were married, they needed a bigger, nicer place than what they currently occupied in the castle. Soon the building would be bustling with visitors to the fair. Even without the guests, however, it was no place to raise a family. The idea of a large, sunny flat did appeal to Minnie. Truth was, the castle could be gloomy. Was always gloomy. And Minnie wanted everything as perfect as possible for Anna's visit. She was a bit perplexed, however, as to why Harry would choose a place so far away, on the north side, when there were so many lovely homes in Englewood. She reasoned, perhaps, that he did not want to pay the exorbitant rents that everyone was charging, now that the World's Fair was underway. Holmes and Minnie moved into the new flat on June 1, 1893. Laura Oker, the owner's daughter, said Gordon seemed to be very attentive to his wife. The couple went on bicycle rides and for a time kept a hired girl. "I can only say that his behavior was all that could be wished during his sojourn with us," Miss Oker said. "Minnie Williams he introduced as his wife, and we always addressed her as Mrs. Gordon. She called him Henry." With Minnie housed on Wrightwood Avenue, Holmes found himself free to enjoy his World's Fair hotel. His guests spent most of their time at Jackson Park or on the Midway, and often did not return until after midnight. While present in the hotel, they tended to stay in their rooms, since Holmes provided none of the common areas, the libraries, game parlors, and writing rooms that the big hotels like the Richelieu and the Metropole and the nearby New Julienne offered as a matter of routine. Nor did he supply the darkroom facilities that hotels closest to Jackson Park had begun installing to serve the growing number of amateur photographers, so-called Kodak fiends, who carried the newest portable cameras. The women found the hotel rather dreary, especially at night, but the presence of its handsome and clearly wealthy owner helped dispel some of its bleakness. Unlike the men they knew back in Minneapolis or Des Moines or Sioux Falls, Holmes was warm and charming and talkative, and touched them with a familiarity that, while perhaps offensive back home, somehow seemed all right in this new world of Chicago. Just another aspect of the great adventure on which these women had embarked. And what good was an adventure if it did not feel a little dangerous? As best anyone could tell, the owner also was a forgiving soul. He did not seem at all concerned when now and then a guest checked out without advance notice, leaving her bills unpaid. That he often smelled vaguely of chemicals, that in fact the building as a whole often had a medicinal odor, bothered no one. He was, after all, a physician, and his building had a pharmacy on the ground floor. Prendergast. Patrick Prendergast believed his appointment as corporation counsel was about to occur. He wanted to be ready and began making plans for how to staff his office once the appointment came through. On May 9, 1893, he got out another of his postcards and addressed it to a man named W.F. Cooling in the Staatszeitung building. Prendergast lectured Cooling on the fact that Jesus was the ultimate legal authority, then gave him the good news. "I am candidate for corporation counsel," he wrote. "If I become corporation counsel, you shall be my assistant." Night is the Magician. Despite its incomplete exhibits, rutted paths, and stretches of unplanted ground, the exposition revealed to its early visitors a vision of what a city could be and ought to be. The black city to the north lay steeped in smoke and garbage, but here in the white city of the fair, visitors found clean public bathrooms, pure water, an ambulance service, electric streetlights, and a sewage processing system that yielded acres of manure for farmers. There was daycare for the children of visitors, and much fun was made of the fact that when you left your child at the children's building, you received a claim check in return. Chicago's small but vocal censorians feared that impoverished parents would turn the building into a depository for unwanted children. Only one child, poor Charlie Johnson, was ever thus abandoned, and not a single child was lost, although anxiety invested the closing moments of each day. Within the fair's buildings, visitors encountered devices and concepts new to them and to the world. They heard live music played by an orchestra in New York and transmitted to the fair by long-distance telephone. They saw the first moving pictures on Edison's kinetoscope and watched stunned as lightning chattered from Nikola Tesla's body. They saw even more ungodly things. The first zipper, the first ever all-electric kitchen, which included an automatic dishwasher, and a box purporting to contain everything a cook would need to make pancakes under the brand name Aunt Jemima's. They sampled a new, oddly flavored gum called Juicy Fruit and caramel-coated popcorn called Cracker Jack. A new cereal, Shredded Wheat, seemed unlikely to succeed. Shredded Doormat, some called it. But a new beer did well, winning the exposition's top beer award. Forever afterward, its brewer called it Pabst Blue Ribbon. Visitors also encountered the latest and arguably most important organizational invention of the century, the vertical file, created by Melville Dewey, inventor of the Dewey Decimal System. Sprinkled among these exhibits were novelties of all kinds. A locomotive made of spooled silk, a suspension bridge built out of Kirk's soap, a giant map of the United States made of pickles. Prune makers sent along a full-scale knight on horseback, sculpted out of prunes, and the Avery Salt Mines of Louisiana displayed a copy of the Statue of Liberty carved from a block of salt. Visitors dubbed it Lot's Wife. One of the most compelling and chilling exhibits was the Krupp Pavilion, where Fritz Krupp's pet monster stood at the center of an array of heavy guns. A popular guide to the fair, called the Time Saver, rated every exhibit on a scale of 1 to 3, with 1 being merely interesting and 3 being remarkably interesting, and gave the Krupp Pavilion a 3. For many visitors, however, the weapons were a disturbing presence. Mrs. D.C. Taylor, a frequent visitor to the fair, called Krupp's biggest gun a fearful, hideous thing, breathing of blood and carnage, a triumph of barbarism crouching amid the world's triumphs of civilization. Mrs. Taylor adored the Court of Honor and was struck by the oddly sober manner people adopted as they walked among its palaces. Everyone about us moved softly and spoke gently. No one seemed hurried or impatient. All were under a spell. A spell that held us from the opening of the fair until its close. In the midway, she found a very different atmosphere. Here Mrs. Taylor ventured into the street of Cairo, open at last, and witnessed her first belly dance. She watched the dancer carefully. She takes a few light steps to one side, pauses, strikes the castanets, then the same to the other side, advances a few steps, pauses, and causes her abdomen to rise and fall several times in exact time to the music, without moving a muscle in any other part of her body, with incredible rapidity, at the same time holding her head and feet perfectly rigid. As Mrs. Taylor and her companions left the street, she sang quietly to herself, "My country, 'tis of thee," like a frightened child easing past a graveyard. The fair was so big, so beyond grasp, that the Colombian guards found themselves hammered with questions. It was a disease, rhetorical smallpox, and every visitor exhibited it in some degree. The guards answered the same questions over and over, and the questions came fast, often with an accusatory edge. Some questions were just odd. "In which building is the Pope?" one woman asked. She was overheard by writer Teresa Dean, who wrote a daily column from the fair. "The Pope is not here, madam," the guard said. "Where is he?" "In Italy. Europe, madam." The woman frowned. "Which way is that?" Convinced now that the woman was joking, the guard cheerfully quipped, "Three blocks under the lagoon." She said, "How do I get there?" Another visitor, hunting for an exhibit of wax figures, asked a guard, "Can you tell me where the building is that has the artificial human beings?" He began telling her he did not know, when another visitor jumped in. "I have heard of them," he said. "They are over in the women's building. Just ask for the lady managers." One male visitor, who had lost both his legs and made his way around the fair on false limbs and crutches, must have looked particularly knowledgeable, because another visitor peppered him incessantly with questions, until finally the amputee complained that the strain of answering so many questions was wearing him out. "There's just one more thing I'd like to know," his questioner said, "and I'll not trouble ye any more." "Well, what is it?" "I'd like to know how you lost your legs." The amputee said he would answer only on strict condition that this was indeed the last question. He would allow no others. Was that clear? His persecutor agreed. The amputee, fully aware that his answer would raise an immediate corollary question, said they were bit off. Bit off? How? But a deal was a deal. Chuckling, the amputee hobbled away. As the fair fought for attendance, Buffalo Bill's Wild West drew crowds by the tens of thousands. If Cody had gotten the fair concession he had asked for, these crowds first would have had to pay admission to Jackson Park and would have boosted the fair's attendance and revenue to a welcome degree. Cody also was able to hold performances on Sundays, and being outside the fairgrounds did not have to contribute half his revenue to the exposition company. Over the 6 months of the fair, an average of 12,000 people would attend each of Cody's 318 performances, for a total attendance of nearly 4 million people. Often, Cody upstaged the fair. His main entrance was so close to one of the busiest exposition gates that some visitors thought his show was the World's Fair and were said to have gone home happy. In June, a group of cowboys organized a 1,000-mile race from Chadron, Nebraska to Chicago in honor of the fair and planned to end it in Jackson Park. The prize was a rich one, $1,000. Cody contributed another $500 and a fancy saddle, on condition the race end in his own arena. The organizers accepted. 10 riders, including Rattlesnake Pete and a presumably reformed Nebraska bandit named Doc Middleton, set out from the Baleen Hotel in Chadron on the morning of June 14, 1893. The rules of the race allowed each rider to start with 2 horses and required that he stop at various checkpoints along the way. The most important rule held that when he crossed the finish line, he had to be riding one of the original horses. The race was wild, replete with broken rules and injured animals. Middleton dropped out in Illinois. Four others likewise failed to finish. The first rider across the line was a railroad man named John Barry, riding Poison, who galloped into the Wild West Arena on June 27th at 9:30 in the morning. Buffalo Bill, resplendent in white buckskin and silver, was there to greet him, along with the rest of the Wild West Company and 10,000 or so residents of Chicago. John Barry had to settle for the saddle alone, however, for subsequent investigation revealed that shortly after the start of the race, he had loaded his horses on an eastbound train and climbed aboard himself to take the first 100 miles in comfort. Cody upstaged the fair again in July when exposition officials rejected a request from Mayor Carter Harrison that the fair dedicate one day to the poor children of Chicago and admit them at no charge. The directors thought this was too much to ask, given their struggle to boost the rate of paid admission. Every ticket, even half-price children's tickets, mattered. Buffalo Bill promptly declared Waifs Day at the Wild West and offered any kid in Chicago a free train ticket, free admission to the show, and free access to the whole Wild West encampment, plus all the candy and ice cream the children could eat. 15,000 showed up. Buffalo Bill's Wild West may indeed have been an incongruity, as the directors had declared in rejecting his request for a concession within Jackson Park, but the citizens of Chicago had fallen in love. The skies cleared and stayed clear. Roadways dried and newly opened flowers perfumed the air. Exhibitors gradually completed their installations, and electricians removed the last misconnects from the elaborate circuits that linked the fair's nearly 200,000 incandescent bulbs. Throughout the fairgrounds, on Burnham's orders, cleanup efforts intensified. On June 1, 1893, workers removed temporary railroad tracks that had scarred the lawns near the lagoon and just south of the electricity and mines buildings. A strikingly noticeable change in the general condition of things is the absence of large piles of boxes stacked up in the exterior courts around manufacturers, agricultural, machinery, and other large buildings, the Tribune reported on June 2nd. Unopened crates and rubbish that just 1 week earlier had cluttered the interior of the manufacturers' building, particularly at the pavilions erected by Russia, Norway, Denmark, and Canada, likewise had been removed. And now these spaces presented an entirely different and vastly improved appearance. Although such interior exhibits were compelling, the earliest visitors to Jackson Park saw immediately that the fair's greatest power lay in the strange gravity of the buildings themselves. The Court of Honor produced an effect of majesty and beauty that was far greater than even the dream conjured in the Rookery Library. Some visitors found themselves so moved by the Court of Honor that immediately upon entering, they began to weep. No single element accounted for this phenomenon. Each building was huge to begin with, but the impression of mass was amplified by the fact that all the buildings were neoclassical in design. All had cornices set at the same height. All had been painted the same soft white, and all were so shockingly, beautifully unlike anything the majority of visitors ever had seen in their own dusty hometowns. No other scene of man's creation seemed to me so perfect as this Court of Honor, wrote James Fullerton Muirhead, an author and guidebook editor. The court, he wrote, was practically blameless. The aesthetic sense of the beholder was as fully and unreservedly satisfied as in looking at a masterpiece of painting or sculpture, and at the same time was soothed and elevated by a sense of amplitude and grandeur such as no single work of art could produce. Edgar Lee Masters, Chicago attorney and emerging poet, called the court an inexhaustible dream of beauty. The shared color, or more accurately, the shared absence of color, produced an especially alluring range of effects as the sun traveled the sky. In the early morning when Burnham conducted his inspections, the buildings were a pale blue and seemed to float on a ghostly cushion of ground mist. Each evening the sun colored the buildings ochre and lit the motes of dust raised by the breeze until the air itself became a soft orange veil. One such evening, Burnham led a tour of the fair aboard an electric launch for a group that included John Root's widow, Dora, and a number of foreign emissaries. Burnham loved escorting friends and dignitaries through the grounds, but sought always to orchestrate the journeys so that his friends saw the fair the way he believed it should be seen, with the buildings presented from a certain perspective, in a particular order, as if he were still back in his library showing drawings instead of real structures. He had tried to impose his aesthetic will on all the fair's visitors by insisting during the first year of planning that the number of entrances to Jackson Park be limited to a few, and these situated so that people had to enter first through the Court of Honor, either through a large portal at the rail station on the west side of the park or an entry on the east from the Exposition Wharf. His quest to create a powerful first impression was good showmanship, but it also exposed the aesthetic despot residing within. He did not get his way, however. The directors insisted on many gates, and the railroads refused to channel their exposition traffic through a single depot. Burnham never quite surrendered. Throughout the fair, he said, "We insisted on sending our own guests, whose opinions we specially valued, into the Grand Court first." The electric launch carrying Burnham, Dora Root, and the foreign dignitaries cut silently through the lagoon, scattering the white city reflected upon its surface. The setting sun gilded the terraces on the east bank, but cast the west bank into dark blue shadow. Women in dresses of crimson and aquamarine walked slowly along the embankments. Voices drifted across the water, laced now and then with laughter that rang like crystal touched in a toast. The next day, after what surely had been a difficult night, Dora Root wrote to Burnham to thank him for the tour and to attempt to convey the complexity of her feelings. "Our hour on the lagoon last evening proved the crown of a charming day," she wrote. "Indeed, I fear we would have lingered on indefinitely had not our foreign friends prepared a more highly spiced entertainment. I think I should never willingly cease drifting in that dreamland." The scenes elicited conflicting emotions. "I find it all infinitely sad," she wrote, "but at the same time so entrancing that I often feel as if it would be the part of wisdom to fly at once to the woods or mountains where one can always find peace. There is much I long to say to you about your work of the past 2 years, which has brought about this superb realization of John's vision of beauty, but I cannot trust myself. It means too much to me, and I think, I hope, you understand. For years, his hopes and ambitions were mine, and in spite of my efforts, the old interests still go on. It is a relief to me to write this. I trust you will not mind." If evenings at the fair were seductive, the nights were ravishing. The lamps that laced every building and walkway produced the most elaborate demonstration of electric illumination ever attempted, and the first large-scale test of alternating current. The fair alone consumed 3 times as much electricity as the entire city of Chicago. These were important engineering milestones, but what visitors adored was the sheer beauty of seeing so many lights ignited in one place at one time. Every building, including the manufacturer's building, was outlined in white bulbs. Giant searchlights, the largest ever made and said to be visible 60 miles away, had been mounted on the manufacturer's roof and swept the grounds and surrounding neighborhoods. Large colored bulbs lit the 100-foot plumes of water that burst from the McMonnies fountain. For many visitors, these nightly illuminations were their first encounter with electricity. Hilda Satt, a girl newly arrived from Poland, went to the fair with her father. As the light was fading in the sky, millions of lights were suddenly flashed on, all at one time, she recalled, years later. Having seen nothing but kerosene lamps for illumination, this was like getting a sudden vision of heaven. Her father told her the lights were activated by electric switches. "Without matches?" she asked. Between the lights and the ever-present blue ghosts of the Colombian Guard, whose numbers exceeded the total patrol force of Chicago's police department, the fair achieved another milestone. For the first time, Chicagoans could stroll at night in perfect safety. This alone began to draw an increased number of visitors, especially young couples locked in the rictus of Victorian courtship and needful of quiet, dark places. At night, the lights and the infilling darkness served to mask the exposition's many flaws. Among them, wrote John Ingalls in Cosmopolitan, the unspeakable debris of innumerable luncheons, and to create for a few hours the perfect city of Daniel Burnham's dreams. Night, Ingalls wrote, is the magician of the fair. The early visitors returned to their homes and reported to friends and family that the fair, though incomplete, was far grander and more powerful than they had been led to expect. The early visitors returned to their homes and reported to friends and family that the fair, though incomplete, was far grander and more powerful than they had been led to expect. Montgomery Schuyler, the leading architectural critic of Burnham's day, wrote, "It was a common remark among visitors who saw the fair for the first time that nothing they had read or seen pictured had given them an idea of it or prepared them for what they saw." Reporters from far-flung cities wired the same observation back to their editors, and stories of delight and awe began to percolate through the most remote towns. In fields, dells, and hollows, families terrified by what they read in the papers each day about the collapsing national economy, nonetheless now began to think about Chicago. The trip would be expensive, but it was starting to look more and more worthwhile. Even necessary. If only Mr. Ferris would get busy and finish that big wheel. Modus operandi. And so it began. A waitress disappeared from Holmes's restaurant, where his guests ate their meals. One day she was at work, the next gone, with no clear explanation for her abrupt departure. Holmes seemed as stumped as anyone. A stenographer named Jenny Thompson disappeared, as did a woman named Evelyn Stewart, who either worked for Holmes or merely stayed in his hotel as a guest. A male physician who for a time had rented an office in the castle and who had befriended Holmes, they were seen together often, also had decamped with no word to anyone. Within the hotel, chemical odors ebbed and flowed like an atmospheric tide. Some days the halls were suffused with a caustic scent, as of a cleanser applied too liberally. Other days with a silvery medicinal odor, as if a dentist were at work somewhere in the building easing a customer into a deep sleep. There seemed to be a problem with the gas lines that fed the building, for periodically the scent of uncombusted gas permeated the halls. There were inquiries from family and friends. As always, Holmes was sympathetic and helpful. The police still did not become involved. Apparently, there was too much else for them to do, as wealthy visitors and foreign dignitaries began arriving in even greater numbers, shadowed by a swarm of pickpockets, thugs, and petty swindlers. Holmes did not kill face to face, as Jack the Ripper had done, gorging himself on warmth and viscera, but he did like proximity. He liked being near enough to hear the approach of death in the rising panic of his victims. This was when his quest for possession entered its most satisfying phase. The vault deadened most of the cries and pounding, but not all. When the hotel was full of guests, he settled for more silent means. He filled a room with gas and let the guest expire in her sleep, or crept in with his passkey and pressed a chloroform-soaked rag to her face. The choice was his, a measure of his power. No matter what the approach, the act always left him in possession of a fresh supply of material, which he could then explore at will. The subsequent articulation by his very talented friend Chapel constituted the final phase of acquisition, the triumphal phase, though he used Chapel's services only sparingly. He disposed of other spent material in his kiln or in pits filled with quicklime. He dared not keep Chapel's frames for too long a time. Early on, he had made it a rule not to retain trophies. The possession he craved was a transient thing, like possessing the scent of a fresh-cut hyacinth. Once the scent was gone, only another acquisition could restore it. But Holmes's arrogance, his sense of exemption, was growing, and one day soon, in the midst of his most ambitious acquisition, he would break his rule against trophies. A fatal mistake. One Good Turn. In the first week of June 1893, Ferris's men began prying the last timbers and planks from the falsework that had encased and supported the big wheel during its assembly. The topmost rim arced through the sky at a height of about 25 stories, higher than Burnham's Masonic Temple, the city's tallest skyscraper. None of the 36 cars had been hung. They stood on the ground like the coaches of a derailed train, but the wheel itself was ready for its first rotation. Standing by itself, unbraced, Ferris's wheel looked dangerously fragile. It is impossible for the non-mechanical mind to understand how such a brobding nag continues to keep itself erect, wrote Julian Hawthorne, son of Nathaniel. It has no visible means of support, none that appear adequate. The spokes look like cobwebs. They are after the fashion of those on the newest make of bicycles. On Thursday, June 8th, Luther Rice signaled the firemen at the big steam boilers 700 feet away on Lexington Avenue, outside the Midway, to build steam and fill the 10-inch underground mains. Once the boilers reached suitable pressure, Rice nodded to an engineer in the pit under the wheel, and steam whooshed into the pistons of its twin 1,000-horsepower engines. The drive sprockets turned smoothly and quietly. Rice ordered the engine stopped. Next, workers attached the 10-ton chain to the sprockets and to a receiving sprocket at the wheel. Rice sent a telegram to Ferris at his office in the Hamilton Building in Pittsburgh. Engines have steam on and are working satisfactorily. Sprocket chain connected up and are ready to turn wheel. Ferris was unable to go to Chicago himself, but sent his partner W.F. Grenau to supervise the first turn. In the early morning of Friday, June 9th, as his train passed through the south side, Grenau saw how the great wheel towered over everything in its vicinity, just as Eiffel's creation did in Paris. The exclamations of fellow passengers as to the wheel's size and apparent fragility filled him with a mixture of pride and anxiety. Ferris, himself fed up with construction delays and Burnham's pestering, had told Grenau to turn the wheel or tear it off the tower. Last-minute adjustments and inspections took up most of Friday, but just before dusk, Rice told Grenau that everything appeared to be ready. "I did not trust myself to speak," Grenau said, so merely nodded to start. He was anxious to see if the wheel worked, but at the same time would gladly have assented to postpone the trial. Nothing remained but to admit steam and see what happened. Never had anyone built such a gigantic wheel. That it would turn without crushing its bearings and rotate smoothly and true were engineering hopes supported only by calculations that reflected known qualities of iron and steel. No structure ever had been subjected to the unique stresses that would come to bear upon and within the wheel once in motion. Ferris's pretty wife, Margaret, stood nearby, flushed with excitement. Granau believed she was experiencing the same magnitude of mental strain as he. "Suddenly I was aroused from these thoughts by a most horrible noise," he said. A growl tore through the sky and caused everyone in the vicinity, the Algerians of Bloom's village, the Egyptians and Persians, and every visitor within 100 yards, to halt.